Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I'm David Canfield, and I'm here this week with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And back with us is Hilary Busis.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for coming again. So this week, we are taking a little bit of a mood shift, talking about the potential of a bummer summer, I think is the best way to put it. So we're going to start by just talking a little bit about The Fall Guy, doing a bit of a postmortem on that box office and how it is setting up a potentially grim few months commercially for movies and theatrical. From there, we're going to talk about a few recent releases that also, I would argue, are not great and come from actors turned directors. It's the directorial debuts of Jerry Seinfeld, the film Unfrosted, which is streaming on Netflix, and Chris Pine, the film Pool Man, which is hitting select theaters on Friday. And then things kind of stay bad. It's been a rough month so far for TV as well. So lots of things to get really excited about.
Yep.
And of course, we invited Hilary to help us work through this. So welcome, Hilary.
Yes, noted hater, Hilary Busis.
Noted hater.
Yeah. Publicists, if you're listening, maybe just don't listen to this episode.
We've been very nice lately. There's been a lot to be happy
about. I love what I do. There's plenty I like.
Yeah, it's just a bad week, guys.
It's a bad week, and a bad week with some ominous undertones for what's coming up. So let's talk a little bit about The Fall Guy. We were, you know, mixed to positive on that when we talked about it last week. It actually got adjusted down from when I last checked in terms of its box office total to $27 million, which is frankly not good for a movie with its budget, marketing spend, the fact that it had this corridor all to itself, essentially. What did you guys make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to an episode of The Town about this, so my thanks to Matt Bellany for probably inspiring everything I'm about to say. But yeah, I was disappointed because this is, though based on an old TV show, otherwise pretty original compared to, you know, IP stuff that tends to clutter up the summer movie theaters. And the leads are so charming, and it is a charming enough movie. And I just hope that a marketing blitz and the sort of Barbie Oppenheimer of it all would kind of propel this movie, propel people to the theater out of curiosity. But I think there are two kind of prevailing potential explanations for why this happened. One is that first trailer, and maybe every trailer for this movie, kind of didn't do enough work to tell you what the movie was about. It just showed you kind of funny, amusing, or, you know, exciting snippets of scenes, but there wasn't really a plot that they could kind of advertise. So that was a problem. I also think if you look back at lead performer Ryan Gosling's career, he's never actually been much of a box office draw. You know, you look to like First Man and Blade Runner 2049 and other things like that. You know, he's popular, he's well-liked, but as they said on The Town, like a lot of those popular, well-liked movies are things like Barbie and The Notebook and whatever. And that those aren't action movies, you know, that are aiming at a particular demographic. I mean, this movie is aiming for a pretty wide demographic in that it's a romantic comedy and it's an action movie. And, you know, but I just think that maybe the Gosling factor was a little bit overestimated post-Barbie, and that didn't help the movie at all.
Now, you're saying The Place Beyond the Pines wasn't number one at the box office in 2012?
That's... I mean, it would have been if I had my druthers. Yeah.
The overestimation of Gosling, as you say, doesn't even take into account that this movie was shot in 2022.
Right.
And I wonder where this movie would be if not for Barbenheimer, which obviously gives it an immediate, probably modest lift, but still one where you can have a hook beyond... Here's Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in an, you know, essentially original to the vast majority of the audience storyline and title. It's a tough sell, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and Emily Blunt was an Oppenheimer. We have two Barbenheimer stars united here, showing, I guess, that they are not necessarily enough. But no, she's certainly a box office draw. She's been in plenty of high grossing movies, stuff from Devil Wears Prada to like Jungle Cruise to, you know, A Quiet Place. I think that probably an unfamiliarity with the IP actually did work against it. And I guess that maybe it just wasn't pushed as well as like an Anyone But You, which is I feel like a kind of decent comparison. Like that was a movie that took a lot of people by surprise by performing as well as it did. And it was kind of coasting entirely on the charm of its two leads. But I don't know. I'm kind of surprised that Fall Guy did so much worse than that.
Yeah. I mean, it was too expensive, probably. You know, if a movie had made close to $30 million and it had maybe a little more than half the budget of what they ended up spending on it, we'd be like, oh, okay, you know, that's not so bad. But, you know, I think they were treating this like a kickoff to summer blockbuster, but that's a slot that has now for years been dominated by Marvel, and this is not that. And so that's, you know, a problem. And I think that Anyone But You also had a certain, you know, Gen Z youth interest factor that maybe two stars, beloved as they are, in their 40s, don't quite carry in the same way. And, you know, Anyone But You got to be like a surprise sleeper hit, whereas The Fall Guy is a disappointment because of those things, you know, like budget and whatnot.
Yeah. If it had been undersold, then... Right.
Yeah.
You could kind of spin the performance in a lot of different ways.
We're in a different box office climate than pre-COVID, obviously. And one franchise that I'm interested in that is coming back this week is Planet of the Apes. Because it's a creatively successful franchise, number one. And number two, it's one that has not been around since COVID. And it's one that I have my eye on as a real question mark in terms of can it sustain the success that it had before, given these challenges that we're talking about, in addition to the fact that it is Planet of the Apes. I don't know what the appeal is in that franchise right now.
Yeah, I mean, for our purposes, we are not a box office podcast. We are not The Town. What I most care about is that those movies are good. And, you know, so this is the fourth in the kind of reboot franchise. And the second one, which is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, right? Yeah, it's Rise, then Dawn, then War, and now Kingdom.
We're Kingdom, yeah.
You could just say nouns, and I would be like, yeah, that sounds good.
Sure, yeah. Jubilee of the Planet of the Apes. But the second one is, like, if that movie maybe were come out more recently, I don't know, I think that would have been, like, a Best Picture contender, maybe. Like, that movie is really good. And you know, the third one is really good, too. I have high hopes for the fourth, which I'm seeing this afternoon. But, yeah, in terms of, like, do audiences still care? Has it been too long since the last one? It's the fourth movie. Has it run out of steam? You know, the original franchise ran for many more than four movies, but I don't know. I hope it does well, because to have a 1-2 punch of Fall Guy and then now then Apes not doing well, that would be disappointing. And then we have Furiosa to wonder about, which, you know, coming off of a beloved fourth installment in a franchise. So this would be the fifth, right? And like that, a social sentiment embargo has lifted. I do like the movie. I won't say much more than that. But again, Mad Max Fury Road came out 9 years ago. That's more of a gap than between Apes films. But I don't know. I just worry that these movies are using the wrong model to predict their success and also maybe budget their movies.
But yeah, I mean, if these long-running franchises can't figure it out, and then something original like Fall Guy can't figure it out, then it's kind of like, what are people looking for? Like, what does appeal at a post-COVID box office?
Low-budget horror, which even that's not doing that well this year, so...
No, it is not.
I don't know.
They'll just re-release Barbie every year, maybe? Yeah. They can just, like, do, like the direct-to-DVD Anchorman sequel that was just cut scenes from the first film.
Right, exactly. I really wish there'd been a post-credit scene at the end of Anyone But You, teasing more to come, and that would send people back to the theaters.
I was looking, Hillary, at some preview you put together for us, which listeners can check out on vf.com right now, and there's just so many question marks along those lines. Movies that I am perhaps personally excited to see. Richard, you mentioned Furiosa. That and Hitman are both coming out in theaters technically on the same day, both creatively really strong movies. Hitman is getting a very limited theatrical release before it hits Netflix in June. And beyond that, you have a lot of movies that are continuing franchises where I just don't know how strong they are, like a Bad Boys or an Inside Out. Some of them
A new Beverly Hills Cop.
A new Janet Planet. That's a franchise in my heart.
Janet, Planet of the Apes.
I mean, the planet helps. Yeah, that word being in the title, maybe that confuses enough people. Yeah, well, the Bad Boys thing is interesting because the most recent one was the third one, and it came out in the winter and did really well. I don't know why I guess because it did well, now they're like, all right, well, let's put all our chips in and put it out in the summer. But I don't know. That, again, that seems like maybe the wrong way to have thought about how to position the movie.
Well, one thing worth noting is we are in an era where a big creative and breakout commercial success, particularly in the summer, gets more runway as an Oscar contender than it did even a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I am looking to see what is the potential Top Gun Maverick or Barbenheimer of this lineup. I have absolutely no idea.
Is it Horizon, an American Saga dash chapter
one? We'll know relatively soon.
Maybe it's Horizon, an American Saga dash chapter two.
I know one man who definitely hopes it is that. I mean, Furiosa definitely craft categories, you know, like George Miller. I mean, 3,000 Years of Longing didn't quite go that direction. But like, I don't know. I think that Furiosa should be sort of a contender in that realm. But I don't at the moment see that kind of long lasting commercial, but also well regarded critically and industry wise movie in this summer landscape.
I mean, I will say I've got high hopes for Blink Twice, mm-hmm. Zoe Kravitz's mm. Jeffrey Epstein inspired movie. I don't know. Do you call it a drama? I
was going to call it like
really
a romp based on the trailer.
Yeah. Like, I feel like that seems like it could be a breakout depending on, you know, the movie itself. But it's got all the ingredients. It's got an actor making a directorial debut with something really buzzy. It's got a cast stacked with people whose names, you know, get audiences excited. I think that there could be something there.
Yeah. And also it does seem just from the trailer to have maybe also a sort of thriller Get Out element to it, right? Like, so it could kind of satisfy a lot of different people.
It could be Get Out. It could be Don't Worry, Darling. But well, in either case, I'm kind of excited.
Don't Worry, Darling didn't do that bad. And it was like, mm-hmm. it was good for us because people were actually paying attention to a movie that was coming out.
The one I'm maybe naively hopeful about is Twisters. This is from mm-hmm. Lee Isaac Chung, who directed Minari. This is a standalone sequel to the 1996 film Twister. Obviously, an abrupt shift in scale for him, but the trailer I thought looked really well mounted. You have stars like Glenn Powell and Daisy Edgar-Jones, who in their own way have commanded box office successes. And I don't know, it feels like the kind of throwback that could also perhaps spur some kind of engagement among a new audience, a new generation, and that's the sweet spot, I believe.
I mean, yeah. I guess a weather movie is a climate story in 2024, which has some potential for...
You know, there's two tornadoes this time, Hillary. So,
yeah,
is one of them made of plastic and like coming out of the Pacific Ocean?
Twins.
Yeah. Yeah, I have high hopes for Twisters. I have a good friend who is works in our industry who thinks, oh my God, that's going to be such a disaster. No one remembers the movie from 1996. And I'm like, I don't even know if that matters. I think that, yes, for older people like myself, we have a fondness for that movie, although I rewatched it recently. It's not very good. But also, you have the Glenn Powell factor. And it's also such a simple concept to sell. You know, the mm-hmm. trailer is just like, look at that big fucking tornado. and that's, I don't know. I just think because that played during the Super Bowl, right? The mm-hmm. first kind of look at that movie, like it seemed, at least from my little corner of online, that like people were sort of laughing at it with it, you know, which is maybe the right kind of combination you need for something like this. It's just dumb summer fun, although maybe smart dumb summer fun in that it's directed by Lee Isaac Chung, who made the beautiful movie Minari. This is a wild pivot away from that, although he's staying roughly in the same, you know, geographical area. And I don't, that adds a certain kind of curiosity factor to maybe more discerning viewers. So maybe that is the kind of multi-quadrant thing that could not do Top Gun Maverick levels of business and acclaim, but sort of be a cousin of that movie.
And a similar principle, right? Of you don't have Tom Cruise here, but a franchise, now a franchise, continuing off of a movie that a lot of people don't know or don't remember, that hopefully injects something fresh and accessible.
Glenn Powell. Glenn Powell is really having a year.
And there's our through line, by the way, with Top Gun Maverick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I also think that given the success of Iron Claw, we should not downplay the box office might of one Maura Tierney, who is in Twisters.
You have a line in...
Maura Tierney's in Twisters? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Oh, yeah, she plays the Twister, David. No.
Richard has a line in the blurb that he wrote that really cracked me up, which is, we finally get to see Maura Tierney in a weather-based thriller, something many of us have long desired.
He's right. True. He's right. Oh, wow. Sorry. I somehow
this
did
changes
not...
everything for
this
you, David.
Really does.
David just pre-ordered tickets while we were recording.
Gonna pre-book that Maura Tierney Little Gold Men interview for the Emmys try period. Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Dumb Summer Not So Fun, maybe.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs. Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%, based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So, Hilary, Richard, we've all seen the movie Pool Man. Chris Pine directs and co-writes this movie and also stars as a pool cleaner in Los Angeles who uncovers a Chinatown-esque mystery. And I did not think it was very good, guys. I hate to say it.
David, I don't think you're alone in that estimation. But yeah, so David, you and I both saw this at the Toronto Film Festival last year. Richard, you saw it a lot more recently than that. I'm very curious, before we get into it, what are your thoughts?
Well, I did this in a loving spirit of sort of competition, in that, like, you two had not liked it months ago and a lot of other people hadn't liked it months ago. And I said, you know what? Maybe I'll see it differently. And, you know, maybe when the festival pressure is off, there's something will reveal itself in Pool Man that just wasn't visible when you're in the high stress environment of the Toronto Film Festival. That did not pan out. I do see what everyone
An
was
admirable
saying.
Spirit.
Yeah, I really did go in open-minded, I swear. And I do think that there are a few things to like in the movie. I think Stephen Tobolowsky is really good in it. A long-time character actor. The movie is sort of a pay on to LA and people sort of existing on the fringes of the entertainment world to some degree. And I think that Stephen Tobolowsky, like, really, like, embodies that very well. I also think, and this is something we can talk about further when we go into the more sort of general idea of actors directing, but, like, I think Chris Pine, like, has a directorial eye. I think the problem is in the writing.
Mm-hmm. The problem is kind of in the directing too, though.
I was going to give a more significant than that, Hilary, but go on.
No. I mean, I think that he may have a directorial eye. I don't know how good he is at directing dialogue, though, because the movie's, it's not a tight movie. It's short, but somehow, you know, scenes just kind of trail off. There's a lot of fat still somehow for something that is kind of meant to be, I don't want to say shallow, because that's a pool pun and it's lame, but I think that he's not trying to make, like, a great piece of art that will, like, stand the test of time. I think he's trying to make something fun, and I just don't think that he does it. I don't think he gets there.
Yes. I mean, to me, watching this, the thing that kept running through my head was, at what point did a producer or one of the fantastic actors in this, one of the many fantastic actors in this movie, stop and perhaps think to themselves, this is not working, / should I say something? I mean, the dead air that we experienced Hillary in a Toronto screening room at almost every quote-unquote joke. I don't even know how to describe some of the tonal approaches to in this movie. Signal that it's very difficult to imagine that was not flagged somewhere along the way, that this movie just isn't funny and it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and a bad comedy is so much worse than a bad drama.
Yes.
Yeah, and I feel like it's rare for me to see a movie that, even if it's a bad comedy, that something doesn't amuse me in it. And I just didn't find anything in this amusing. And like, we should describe the movie. It is a modern comedy, but with noir elements. You know, Pine plays this kind of hapless pool guy who has a sort of, he's in heavy therapy with Annette Bening's character. He's sort of soul searching all the time. He's got a ton of civic outrage. And so he's constantly going to, you know, city council meetings and making his case for more public transportation and all this stuff. I mean, he's fighting for good causes. He's kind of annoying. And then he gets sucked into this kind of potential criminal conspiracy, a la the movie Chinatown. So you watch this movie and you're like, okay, they're referencing Chinatown. But then don't worry, they say several times out loud that they're referencing Chinatown. And it's just like, you don't need to take us that far. We get it. Hopefully we get it, you know.
It doesn't assume that its audience is smart, which is sort of
it doesn't assume its audience insulting. Is smart, but it assumes they deeply care about Los Angeles, you know.
Yes.
And as someone who lives in New York, you and I both, Hillary, like, I understand there are a lot of movies and TV and whatever about New York that are annoyingly, you know, aggrandizing about this city and isn't it so special, blah, blah, blah. So maybe this is my bias speaking, but like, this movie is so insistent that everyone who watches it has a deep, deep love of Los Angeles without kind of showing us why. And that I'm not trash talking the city. It's just the way the movie kind of advertises the city assumes a lot. And it reminded me, with the noir element and the sort of very baked in LA stuff, of Under the Silver Lake, a sort of
forgotten
movie with Andrew Garfield. Yeah.
Very similar to Under the Silver Lake.
Yeah. And it also seems very clearly inspired by The Big Lebowski in a way that it doesn't consciously reference as much, maybe because it doesn't want you to be making that unfavorable comparison.
Instead of the dude, we have the pool man. And yes, I thought of Lebowski a lot in that I felt like Chris Pine, as a director and star of this movie, so desperately wants you to find this character endearing and witty and sort of strangely beguiling. And I just found him grating and not interesting, you know, in a really fundamental, basic way. There's nothing to really grab onto with him beyond him being the pool man. I just didn't get it.
It's just a collection of random quirks. I mean, it feels sketchy in like the comedy set, like sketch comedy sense a lot of the time. It doesn't hang together. It feels, you know, he's like writing letters to Aaron Brockovich for some reason, and there's no payoff to that. It's not like Aaron Brockovich shows up at the end, or, you know, God forbid, Julia Roberts. It just feels like a bunch of a random jumble that was tossed together, I don't know, during the pandemic maybe, and then somebody gave him enough money to actually get it made. It feels like a screenwriting exercise or something that then became a film.
Yeah. And I think that I can appreciate at least some of the intent behind the movie, you know, the political dimension of it, where it's this shaggy comedy about someone fighting the good fight, you know, to better a sort of ailing city and to, you know, housing equality and all that stuff. Like, that's good. But I think that those are pretty big, complicated topics to handle when you can't even get a joke to land, you know. It kind of reminds me also, it's Under the Silver Lake, but also remember that movie Roman J. Israel Esquire, the Denzel Washington
Academy
movie?
Award nominated film.
Yeah,
Richard.
Another that's more of a drama, but a sort of shaggy sort of LA story about someone kind of just, you know, working with and against the system. And, you know,
it's about an annoying guy who just like
an annoying weirdo who, you know, mostly has his heart in the right place. I don't dislike the genre of movie that Pool Man is maybe half trying to be. I just wish that, yeah, David, maybe one of those onset conversations had happened where someone politely, compassionately pulled Chris Pine aside and said, like, let's bring in a joke writer. Let's rethink some of this because it's not playing.
So the obvious problem here is that you have, I think, a big star with a certain amount of latitude to make the movie that they want to make, even if they are not perhaps equipped to make that movie. This premiered in Toronto, as we mentioned, and it was a part of a really wide array of not well-received directorial efforts from actors. You had Patricia Arquette's Gonzo Girl, Kristin Scott Thomas's North Star. I truly forgot the title. I don't think that movie has distribution even. Anna Kendrick had a film there that kind of ran away with the festival because it was solid and it stood out so dramatically from the others.
And we should say also that it seemed as though there were a lot more actor-directed projects than usual, maybe to get around the SAG strike that was still happening at the time and get these actors to show up as directors.
Exactly. It was a weird, weird vibe.
I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but it doesn't seem out of line to propose that maybe they programmed these things on purpose to get celebrities to still appear despite the strike.
Well, and then they didn't, those movies for the most part did not accept interim agreements because from what we had heard, it would interrupt the sales process. This film was sold to Vertical Entertainment, which is a smaller distributor, presumably because the reviews were not good and it was not going to have a big release after all. I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk about Unfrosted in a minute, which is another actor's director, very different stature of actor. But there is something to a celebrity bringing their sensibility behind the camera and just kind of getting to do what they want with it, even though it's to absolutely nobody's benefit, from what I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's all contracting now, but I think in recent years, the sort of the streaming, that there could be that many more movies, you know, with lower stakes, let's say, that I think a lot of actors kind of flooded in and said, you know, I've always wanted to direct or whatever. And we had successes. We had Elizabeth Banks, we had Olivia Wilde, you know, Maggie Gyllenhaal. There is precedent, you know, and I think a lot of people who maybe have long held that ambition, and it's not a new sort of, they're not jumping onto a bandwagon, but like now people are more willing to extend that money. You know, it used to be a rarer thing when this happened. And sometimes it worked, you know, incredibly well, like Robert Redford or Warren Beatty, whoever. But and then there are, you know, many examples of where it didn't quite work. Sean Penn, for example. Mm-hmm. I just watched his movie, The Last Face, for the first time recently. And holy cow.
I do like Into the Wild, though.
Yes, Into the Wild's good. And that's the thing when I said about Pool Man that Chris Pine has a directorial eye. I would weirdly be curious to see him direct another movie that he didn't write. I think that's the crucial thing. And I think that that's something that maybe is a problem that plagues a lot of directed by an actor projects, is when they endeavor to also write it, that can yield much shakier results. Sometimes
that's
it works.
Too many things to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also not everyone. I think this is true of non-actors who direct. I think that auteurism is like very, very hip right now. And I'm told that people don't really want to finance an original screenplay if the writer isn't also attached. It's easier to package. You have a narrative there. And I think that is maybe a mistake, because a lot of times people are very good directors and then their movie is hampered by their own script.
Maybe they shouldn't be starring it either. I think that there's also a question of just someone else bringing some other kind of energy, a point of view to material that is rougher. You mentioned actresses like Olivia Wilde and Maggie Gyllenhaal and their debuts, which were very well received. They were not in those movies. And in fact, I believe in the case of Booksmart, Wilde didn't write that either. She got behind the camera. She made a really, really smart teen comedy. In the case of The Lost Daughter, it's with Maggie Gyllenhaal adapted and directed. You had Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley bringing Oscar-nominated heat to a really tricky script. And in this case, it just feels like the Chris Pine show, and it's not a particularly enjoyable one.
I guess that we could say that Pool Man does verge on that dreaded two-word phrase, vanity project.
Mm-hmm. We can.
which is, you know, that does put a certain stink on a movie. But I don't think that the vanity project stink on Pool Man is as near as profound as it is on Frosted.
What a transition.
a movie that I watched recently and think is abominable. I'm not just saying this because Jerry Seinfeld recently said some annoying things about the state of comedy, that, you know, that separate of that, watched in a vacuum, Unfrosted is a complete mess, and talk about jokes that don't land.
Well, yeah, it's the same thing of I mean, I was watching it by myself or with my husband, but the dead air, you can feel it even in a room by yourself.
Yeah, the dog wasn't even laughing.
No. Well, he's not feeling too well. So
right. He was just... Because he watched Unfrosted.
Yeah, he was just miserable to watch the yeah. people eating pastries out of a garbage can or whatever they're doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of frantic mugging from the supporting cast. And they're doing what they can. But yeah, I mean, I do kind of feel like Seinfeld's, interviews are illustrative, though, because he... has said a bunch of times during this press tour, like, he thinks movies are bad. He thinks comedy now is bad. It's like, well, what are you doing here, man? Like, if you think that everything is in the culture is so awful and you don't even really seem to think your movie is that good, like, why did you make it?
The culture is ruined, and so I made a Pop-Tart movie.
To be bored and rich. To be bored and very rich. Jerry Seinfeld is much more of a comedian than he is an actor. I mean, he acted on a sitcom for a decade, but like, you know,
playing
Chris
himself.
Pine, yeah, playing himself. Chris Pine is like an actual actor. And so in my imagination of how things worked, Chris Pine would have been much more preoccupied with his performance and thus distracted in his other duties than probably Seinfeld was in his acting in Unfrosted. But still, there is that sort of distraction factor. There's no distance. You know, I feel like if Jerry Seinfeld, who is a very successful and often in the past quite funny comedian, if he had been able to take a step back and not be on camera and actually watch what was happening, he might have been like, this ain't working. Or he just does think it works.
I think he thinks it works. I think that that's kind of the problem, or that he thinks like we are dumb enough to think it's working, because I think that he holds his audience in very little esteem.
Yeah, the contempt factor is certainly there.
It's like it's dripping in contempt. It's like, oh, you want a movie about fucking stupid shit? Here's the stupidest thing I could possibly think of.
Yep. Here's your slop, your Pop-Tart slop. Yeah. And I think there's also like a kind of in the sort of antic joke a second kind of patter, like there is a sort of almost Tina Fey reference in there in a strange way where it sometimes feels like he's like, I can do it better.
Yes. He thinks he's going a mile a minute here and he's stuffing this thing with gags and zany humor and everything that he has, I suppose, made his name for, but it feels lazy, cheap. I was just even noticing like the fittings on the actors are not particularly good because it's a period film. Like the costumes don't look good. The hair doesn't look good. It just feels so thrown together. And yet it is worth noting this movie is number one on Netflix and has been for a number of days.
I'm sure that plenty of people are swilling it down. I don't have like, I think that Seinfeld's, you know, imprimatur is enough probably to get people to turn it on. I don't know how many people are finishing it, but yeah, it feels so cynical. It feels so, yeah. I mean, half baked comes to mind. But
so Pullman's shallow and Unfrosted's half baked, Hillary.
Yes. I mean, I'm so sorry. put these on the poster, please.
It makes me a little sad and concerned. Netflix is in the midst of a transition with its film strategy. They have a new head. They've had a recent round of layoffs. And I believe that the sort of mid-budget star-driven mantra that they have been, you know, taking around town of late, they probably are looking at this as a huge success. And it is so creatively dire that it just terrifies me as to what a really strong studio at times, right? The one that we're talking about at the end of every year with a slate of at least really interesting and ambitious movies is going to turn toward it. It does make me nervous.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I mean, everything we've talked about in this episode makes me nervous. So,
yeah. And I think we've been dancing around some of these topics as we've talked about things that are good. There's always something good out there. But there has been a lot of worry percolating. And I don't know why it seems to be crystallizing for me this week.
Well, and it's funny, though, because you would think in theory that the contraction of, you know, peak TV and of studios would mean that the stuff that was left would have to be good in order to get made at all, right? Like, we are past the blank check period where anybody could just be like, well, how about I do 10 episodes about my neighbor across the street or whatever. And somebody would say like, yes, here, we'll put it on like Spectrum Blip Blorp and nobody will see it. But like you can make it and we'll stream it. But yeah, that's I would hope that at a time when there's less content, that content that does survive would have to, I don't know, pass some sort of litmus test. But yeah, if that doesn't seem to be happening, then it's certainly worrisome.
And we just want to say that Spectrum Blip Blorp is an advertiser, and we apologize for what Hillary just said. She does not represent the views of this podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about another actor-turned-director, Regina King, whose debut I quite liked, One Night in Miami. She's back with a, unfortunately, less than great series, also on Netflix, so stay with us.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay. Who's going to do their Jeff Daniels A Man in Full impression first?
I can. I'm happy to.
This is my way of introducing A Man in Full, the new Netflix limited series helmed by David E. Kelley. Hillary, why don't you kick this one off for us?
A Man in Full is a television series about a brave chicken named Foghorn Leghorn facing enemies at every turn.
Oh, my God. I really hope people have seen this so they know just how wonderful that was.
Harry, I can't speak to what your problem is. I can tell you that I'm here to address our situation with a business plan.
Our situation? Do you mean the $800 million that you owe this bank? Because that's my problem.
Wisma, what do we have for our new friend Harry?
It is thick. Like, it is a thick accent. It is distracting.
Well, he did so well in To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway. And he's like, so I can just do that just with the volume turned up, right? Like,
the state does not have one iota of evidence against Mr. Robinson.
This is I'm going to take it back a little bit. I'm realizing I was the one who started this. This is Netflix's new 6-part limited series that is also sadly not very good from David E. Kelley. Regina King directed the pilot and the last two episodes. It stars Jeff Daniels. Richard, what did you think of it? What did you think of Hillary's impression, more importantly?
I think Hillary's impression is 10 for 10. I found it entertaining. It's based on a Tom Wolfe novel. So like he knows how to plot something out. I like a lot of the actors in it, including Jeff Daniels. I don't love the performance, but I generally like him. I like Dan Lane. I like, lots of other people involved. And I kept pressing play on the screeners. I didn't finish it, but I was saying this to you off air, David, but like, it feels like it was a big glossy streaming show from like 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like ABC. It's
like House of Cards era, where it's like, oh, we got this like big lauded actor and look, they're doing a show on streaming or television or whatever. Is that enough? And it's based on something respectable, and it doesn't feel at all responsive to modern, very contemporary like ideas about like how TV should work, if we even have an idea of that. It just felt dated in its own right, not just because it's based on something, old.
Yeah, I think that my main vibe from watching as much of it as I did was that it's very fine. It's a great example, I think, of James Poniewozik wrote an essay for The Times a couple of weeks ago about mid-TV, like MID.
Yes, I keep meaning to bring this up. Thank you.
Yes, and I think that this is a perfect example of it. Like, it is made very competently. The production values are good. Like, it has name actors. It's based on, a best-selling book by a beloved high culture author, Tom Wolfe. And you watch it and you're like, okay, this is fine. Like, it doesn't stoke any intense feeling, I think, either way.
I kept thinking about House of Cards, actually, because to me, it had that gloss and that hammy central performance, but it also felt like it had the sheen of the networky turn that Netflix took more recently in order to become more broadly appealing. So it has this weird combination of elements. I also found it watchable. I'm sad you didn't make it to the end, Richard, because the ending is completely off the rails. And don't even understand where it came from, because it is not the ending of the book. There's a lot.
Oh, well, now I'm interested. Okay.
I almost think you should just look it up, but let's just say Jeff Daniels has a delivery of the line, big red dog. And in context, it is horrifying and kind of made me scream.
Like Clifford? Like, does he show up?
Not Clifford. Clifford. No, no, I won't say anything more. It is a spoiler, but dear Lord, it is quite an ending. But it's coming for Netflix at the tail end of its Emmy eligibility period. I don't think it's doing that well on the service. If it hit one, it was at number one for like a day, which for their big premieres is kind of bare minimum. So I'm wondering, do they consider it a throwaway? Was this always considered more of a commercial play? It's in a weird in-between space that I'm struggling to identify in terms of where they want it to be.
I just think on the page, it's like, it's Tom Wolfe, it's Jeff Daniels, it's Regina King hot off of, you know, One Night in Miami. And Regina King, you know, in her own right, beloved actress, very awards bedecked actress. You know, and I think a good director, you know, I think One Night in Miami is well done. But that was one set, you know, it's like a play. I mean, it's based on a play. This requires a lot more moving parts, and it just, yeah. So I'm sure that they thought this will all work because look at all the pedigree behind it, but it has no sense of like urgency to it. You know, it's just like, why this? Why now? Why these people? Like, I understand the appeal for Jeff Daniels. I don't understand the appeal to Regina King necessarily. But yeah, I think the mid description is what fits it best. But I would imagine that at one point it was thought of as one of their higher prestige shows. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think so too. I almost wish that they hadn't updated it, that they had kept it set in the 90s when the book is set, and like made it a period piece. I don't know. Maybe that would have given it like an extra jolt of something rather than seeming dated unintentionally.
It's having this sort of almost obligatory awards campaign. And someone recently asked me about a string of May premieres, which used to be kind of a hot ticket for Emmy season, and why they all seem so bad. And it's evolved into this strange kind of dumping ground of shows that have the level of talent where they have to give the appearance of a campaign, I think. And this happens every year. But that just aren't going to be able to go the distance. And there's quite a few that kind of came out around the same time. And I thought of this in relation to The Veil, which is FX's show streaming on Hulu, which was also received pretty mixed reviews. That one stars Elizabeth Moss, because they're both these really throwbacky genre attempts that don't seem to be clicking, and both seem like really significant investments for their studios. I'm not sure if either of you saw The Veil.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen most of it, and I was watching it, and I was like, what is off about this? and then it wasn't her British accent, which is, I'm told by British friends, off. But it was, then I realized it was written by Stephen Knight, who, you know.
Well, this is where I was getting, yes.
Has done Serenity on film, Serenity, the horrible locked down movie with Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor. He's had better success on TV in the past. But again, it feels like Stephen Knight operating at the, like, let me create a TV show mindset of 10 years ago. You know, there's just not enough of a sense of occasion or why to it. And the story is kind of boring.
There are things I enjoyed about The Veil. The main dynamic between Elizabeth Moss, who plays this MI6 agent, and the actress Yumna Marwan, who is a suspected terrorist who ends up in this sort of Thelma and Louise esque plot with her as they unravel an international conspiracy, has its charms, but the element of Stephen Knight is one that I find really head scratching, because this is another show that has a really impressive budget, impressive production values. Elizabeth Moss obviously commands a certain level on her own. But his last few shows have been, honestly, kind of disastrous. Great Expectations on FX was horribly reviewed. I don't think anybody watched it, as was A Christmas Carol, his other Dickens adaptation. He also wrote All the Light We Cannot See on Netflix, which I found, frankly, ghastly, and was really horribly reviewed as well. I'm not sure what is behind this level of faith. And I was even thinking about that with David E. Kelly. Obviously, he has a long history in television, but it's the same principle of, since Big Little Lies, he's had a lot of shows that haven't really gone anywhere. You know, things like Love and Death on Max, Anatomy of a Scandal on Netflix that were just sort of there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think some of these people kind of just coast on their familiar names. They can probably get things done on time, you know, and like there's probably practical things that come to bear on it, you know. But yeah, in the case of Stephen Knight, it's weird. I mean, maybe like, I don't know, Peaky Blinders has actually made a ton of money for everybody involved. And so everyone wants to kind of chase that. But like, or, you know, everyone just loves Dirty Pretty Things, which Stephen Knight was Oscar nominated for 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, I guess that that's the actual answer to what happens after the contraction, which is that studios are gun shy and reluctant to take risks and will go to these known quantities, these names that have hits in their past, even if they don't have as many hits in their present. And newer voices, riskier voices are going to kind of get lost because there won't be somebody who's willing to take a chance on them.
Right. You know, and I think that there's an analogy to be drawn between that landscape of television and one that I see play out a lot in theater in New York, where when you get a big star, a lot of times they want to do a play that's already been premiered, you know, years ago, like whether it's, you know, 500 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever, something that they can trust, that they can rely on. And because they don't want to take that risk. Very few like big stars debut brand new plays like on Broadway. It happens once in a while, but not often. Mm-hmm. Maybe the same is true of someone like, you know, Jeff Daniels or Elizabeth Moss, where it's like, well, but these guys have track records. And yeah, I see the success of shows like Beef and, you know, I May Destroy You and things like that. But I don't know, that seems maybe a little risky. And I don't know if I trust that. And I think that, you know, that's going to be maybe a continuing problem.
You're mentioning shows from the last few years. And I think this year has been quite illustrative for Netflix in that this is a show that I'm sure when it was developed was firmly on that Emmy calendar, Emmy radar. A Man in Full will not be a heavy hitter in the nominations. A show like Baby Reindeer was nowhere near that, and it will be a heavy hitter in the nominations.
Yeah. That was a person who, yeah, like Richard Gadd, nobody in America, I think, had probably ever heard of him until the show debuted.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think I don't think Netflix is, you know, kicking their heels, because it's not like Baby Reindeer cost a lot. It's a huge win for them. But for FX as well, having a show like Shogun, which spent a lot of creative, careful time on, that paid off in such spectacular fashion, it's that level of creative investment that tends to pay off more than something where you are relying on somebody who has made a name for himself, who has a certain brand, but who hasn't been delivering that kind of quality content in some time.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, not that Jeff Daniels has like a huge Q score among, you know, younger people or whatever, but he, you know, he's a known entity. But also Jeff Daniels has done a lot of random TV over the years, and maybe that sort of gets diluted. So it's actually not that special to have Jeff Daniels back on your television screens.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, he was the lead of The Newsroom like 10 years ago.
He's in another show right now called American Rust on Amazon Prime that I had never heard of. And you know who the co-lead in that is, Richard?
Who? Oh, Maura Tierney.
Tierney.
That's right. That's right.
You know, it all comes back.
Jeff Daniels did the Comey rule, or did he do the Fox News one? I don't remember.
He did the Comey rule.
It was Russell Crowe played Roger Ailes.
Right. And he did the Looming Tower about the lead up to 9/11. Like, you know, it's just like, I think that maybe there should be more discernment about not just what these actors and their teams are deciding they should do, but also on the network side, the streamer side, like, how can we best use this kind of beloved entity and not just cram them into things and hope they work because the right names are attached.
We just named so many limited drama series that I forgot existed in the span of 2 minutes.
You know. you know, I am the webmaster of jeffdaniels.net.
I can't believe you forgot all of that work.
That does it for this week's show. You can email us anytime at littlegoldmen@vf.com, or you can find us on the internet. I'm at davidcanfield97, and Richard?
Rylas.
And Hillary?
Hillabuster.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best pitch that will save Pixar goes to Hillary Busis.
A brave chicken.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.